Hey, what's going on? It's At The Letters for Wednesday, July 5th, 2023. Arden Swelling, Ben Nicholson-Smith, our producer, is Christian Ryan. Ben, the Blue Jays, as we sit here today on July the 5th, are 46-40. It's a .535 winning percentage. They've kind of been hovering around that .530, .535, .538 winning percentage mark as they crossed halfway point in the season. What do you make of it? What does that say about this team? Are they good enough? Are they not good enough? Where do they fit in this AL postseason race?
Not where they want to be, that's for sure. I mean, I think that they're good enough to do a lot of things. They're good enough to win a lot of games and make a deep run, which is still their goal and still should be their goal. You know, at the same time, we can't look at this team without really having an awareness of its flaws and the shortcomings that we've seen to this point in the season, where, you know, they haven't had a fifth starter for a month. That's really worn on them, and obviously that'll change, as we'll touch on here. But this team's pitching staff has its issues. Offensively, you know, we're looking at a lineup right now that's healthy. You know, they have their A lineup out there, but it's just not a great lineup. It's a good lineup rather than a great lineup. So I think it's been a good team rather than a great team. And so with that, you have all kinds of, you know, pressure at this point because they're two games out and they need to gain that ground. They can't afford to miss the playoffs this year. So at some point, they have to start making up that ground in the standings and really showing that they are better than either the Astros or the Yankees or the Orioles or some combination of all three.
Yeah, the good news is that they haven't lost much of that ground, because really every team in the AL wildcard race has been middling for like the last month. You look at like the Angels falling off, the Yankees, the Astros have just been kind of, both those teams around, you know, right around that 530 mark that the Jays have been at over the last 30 games or so. Like the Orioles haven't run away with it yet, and the Red Sox just kind of hanging around. So it is still, and the Mariners, by the way, too, is just hanging around. So it is very like muddled, I guess, and I would imagine that it'll remain that way for the rest of the year, and we'll really go into September with not that much separation between the four or five, perhaps even six teams like competing for three wildcard spots. And then we're just going to find out how those clubs perform over their final 28 or so games. When it comes to the lineup, which you said for the Blue Jays really hasn't done enough just yet, like the offense has not done enough for the Blue Jays to win as much as they had envisioned that they were going to. I'm still pretty bullish about it over the back half of the season, over the final 75, 76 games, whatever it is, because like if I just took all the offenses in baseball and I removed the team names from all of them and I just looked purely at their numbers, and I was like, okay, like let's find an offense that has really underperformed its run expectancy and its potential to this point, one that has like a lot of positive indicators that suggest that it'll regress to the mean and perform better over the second half. Like there's a lot of things about the Blue Jays offense that would stick out at me. You know, they don't chase a ton, they don't strike out a lot, they make really hard contact consistently, they use the whole field, they hit the ball in the air a lot, like they just have a really solid process. So I would look at that offense with the name removed and say that's the one. Like that one with a strangely low home run total for the amount of hard contact that it makes, hard contact in the air especially, that's the one that I think is going to positively regress, because home run outcomes are hugely impacted by luck. And this is an offense that just looks like it deserves better results to the process that it's shown so far. So if that process remains consistent, I would honestly expect the Blue Jays to perform better offensively over the second half.
Agreed. I mean, they've been pretty middling when it comes to runs scored, and obviously runs scored is, you know, a fair way. It's the end result. It's the end goal, obviously. So it's definitely not unfair to judge the Blue Jays by their runs scored total. And based on runs, they're very much middle of the pack when it comes to Major League Baseball. Now, as we move ahead, definitely would expect that to improve. Their OPS is more like 10th in Major League Baseball. Their WRC plus is even better than that. So there are a lot of indicators, as you said, the hard hit rate. So I think that's positive. I think they will improve. Now, I think there's a limit at the same time to that improvement and how much I would project them to improve, partly because they have a lot of old players. So I'm just not sure that, you know, as I said, right now, this team is healthy. Are you going to expect Kevin Kiermaier and Brandon Belt and Whit Merrifield and George Springer, et cetera, to stay healthy to the extent that they have as the season progresses? And furthermore, this is a team that has really struggled in some situations. And I've talked about this at length already on At the Letters and elsewhere, but I really think they need a right-handed bat. This is a ball club that has really, really poor production left on left. They have zero home runs left on left this year. They're last in Major League Baseball when it comes to home runs against left-handed pitching. All of that to me points to a need for a right-handed bat. They don't have one. They don't have one coming. So I think that, yes, the offense should improve, but part of that improvement should come from outside the organization, because internally, I just see some weak spots right now.
Yeah, that's kind of the pessimistic side of the optimistic viewpoint that I presented. It's that for the lack of fortune, I guess, or you know, positive outcomes that the Blue Jays have had for their process and for, you know, how hard they hit the ball and just the shape of their offense, they've had really strong fortune and really good luck in terms of just availability and durability and players staying off the injured list. Like, the Blue Jays haven't had very many uh-oh moments yet. And like, that uh-oh moment for me is when we go into like John Schneider's office before a game and he says, yeah, so-and-so is going to miss his next start just to let some elbow inflammation subside. Or, you know, so-and-so is going to the IL because, you know, he felt something in a bullpen. We haven't had like the so-and-so got hit by a pitch and fractured his hamate as Mike Trout just did and is going to miss like 7 to 8 weeks. We haven't had the so-and-so used too much sticky stuff on his glove and got, you know, the Brandon Hyde, or, you know, asked the umps to check and yep, you got thrown out of a game and now there's a 10 game suspension and you're going without that roster spot, that not only that player but that roster spot for the next 10 games. I mean, stuff like this happens all the time across this league, and the Blue Jays have somewhat miraculously avoided those outcomes to this point. So you almost do have to bake in that turning a little bit over the final 10 weeks.
Right. And with that, you know, I think a lot of that happens with the offense, where you look at this offense and as I said, a lot of their older players, guys in their 30s, have been really healthy. And that's a credit to the training staff. It's a credit to the players themselves. It is also reckless to assume that that will just continue. And then when you look beyond the offense, all right, you look at a pitching staff that, yeah, they've run four deep for the last month, but each one of those four guys has taken the ball extremely consistently. And in Gausman, Bassett, and Berríos, they've got three guys who are on pace to surpass 180 innings, maybe push close to 200 innings on the season. There are just not a lot of teams that have that kind of durability at the front of their rotation. And so this could be one of those years where they just have great health from their rotation. But man, it really would help if a Manoah can come back, if a Ryu can come back, because the depth behind that front four has been really shaky for the last month.
Yeah, and even if you want to look at the bullpen as well, like if you just order the major league leaders in terms of appearances among relievers, Eric Swanson's name is going to be right up at the top of that list. Jordan Romano's is not going to be far behind. Tim Mays's is going to be up there. Jimmy Garcia's is going to be up there. Like, the Blue Jays are asking a lot of some of their higher leveraged relievers, Eric Swanson in particular, and like his usage to this point, 41 outings at this point in the season, like it's just not sustainable.
Yes, he did. Turner goes around, and what a job by Swanson getting three big outs.
You're going to have to back him off. You're going to have to get him some more rest, because we've seen that at times he's taken the mound without his best stuff, without his best command and location, because he's been overused, and we've seen the results that come from that. So you want him to be feeling as healthy and effective as possible going into the stretch run late in September, and you hope into October when you are going to be using him on back-to-backs, maybe even three times in a row, three out of four. Same thing with Jordan Romano. Nate Pearson, a guy who hasn't had a ton of effectiveness when pitching on back-to-backs. Like, the Blue Jays are going to have to find a way to manage their bullpen arms more effectively down the stretch and just lighten up the workload if they're going to have some of these pitchers available and effective come the most important games of the season.
For sure. And I still think this team, despite their underperformance, like, this has not been a great start to the season for the Blue Jays. And there are a lot of questions around this team, and we'll obviously get into some of those. But, you know, I still think that their upside is as high as ever. I mean, they have a shot to win series in October and push deep into the final month of the season. I really believe that. Now, I think that they would need a ton of things to go right. Now, inevitably, whatever team makes it to the World Series does have a ton of things go right. Could the Blue Jays be that team? I mean, yeah, I think that still is on the table. So you still have to push forward as though that is the goal and push forward in the hopes that you can make that happen. But, you know, there's no guarantee. And obviously, the likelihood is they'll be knocked out before that. And as things stand now, they wouldn't even make the playoffs. So there's a ton of work to go before, you know, we're talking too much about that stuff.
Yeah, you're going to want to change that. How much of that comes down, Ben, to the Blue Jays' performance against the American League East, against the teams that they are directly competing with in their division? I believe it's 7-20 now against the AL East. It's 0-7 against the Boston Red Sox. Is there an explanation for this? Is there a reason why this is happening, or is baseball just a really weird sport?
Well, you know, I'll be curious to hear your answer on this. To me, I just look at it pretty simply, and I say the American League East includes five really, really good teams. And so when you're playing really good teams, you're going to lose a higher percentage of your games. Your expected winning percentage is going to be lower. Everyone in baseball does worse against the American League East. The Blue Jays have done worse than we would expect, even knowing that the American League East is a behemoth of a division. They have underperformed with that expectation in mind. But yeah, it's bad. I mean, it obviously has cost them. They had a chance to put away the Red Sox over the weekend, totally whiffed on that chance. Very frustrating weekend. Take nothing away from, you know, that frustration. But, you know, I don't think there's some like fatal flaw here that the Blue Jays can't beat teams from the American League East. I think it's just a reflection of A, really good division, B, Blue Jays team that just hasn't played great baseball overall.
I think there is a lot of weirdness to it as well. Like, I think it is just the nature of baseball that it's often going to defy that perfect, tidy, silver bullet explanation that, like, our brains crave for everything and that, like, movies have taught us that is just exists for all, you know, all the events and circumstances of life. Like, I think it's just a weird sport. Like, the Blue Jays and the Red Sox, you can point to, like, more than a few just weird swing games here that very easily could have gone the other way. Kevin Gausman had a blow-up outing in one of those games at Fenway Park. You know, Kevin Gausman, who is like a Cy Young contender and the ace of this pitching staff and has been really, really good, one of the better starters in the AL going to the All-Star game. He allowed like five runs in an inning against the Red Sox. There was the Connor Wong game. Connor Wong, who's like a career 2-0 hitter, went 4-for-4 one day with two homers and a double. Against some pretty good Blue Jays pitchers. I believe he took Eric Swanson deep. I think the double came off of Kikuchi. I mean, like, you know, he wasn't doing this against, like, it wasn't like an Alek Manoah, you know, tough start sort of thing. Connor Wong just went off and had the game of his life. Alex Verdugo has hit two home runs to win games for the Red Sox against the Toronto Blue Jays. Since May 1st, Alex Verdugo has hit two home runs. This is a span of like 220 plate appearances. Both those home runs have come off of Jordan Romano to win games. Like, it's just insanely weird stuff that is happening in these Blue Jays Red Sox matchup. You can even look at like the Bo Bichette, Louis Rivera miscommunication at third base. You know, did Rivera get the stop sign up early enough? Did Bo pick Rivera up early enough? Did he run through the stop sign? Should Rivera have been more adamant? Like, you can break that down however many ways you want to. Still an incredibly weird play that sees the final out of the game, Bo Bichette being representing the tying run, being made at home plate. So, like, there are, what, four swing games that I just gave you where really weird and unexpected things happened. I think it's just the nature of baseball. The Blue Jays struggles against the Red Sox and why they've gone 0-7 against them this year.
Yeah, for sure. And even, you know, you look at Masataka Yoshida, he's basically Tony Gwynn against the Blue Jays. He's been absolutely incredible. Or James Paxton, you know, he's even this year, right? He's had his issues coming back from injuries, left to start early due to a knee issue recently. But against the Jays, perfect form, sitting 97, nasty cutter, like absolutely incredible performance. Now, take nothing away from Paxton. That's part of the reason the Red Sox are a solid team this year. And if they do decide to sell, Paxton could be the best acquisition that anyone makes at the trade deadline, but he's not a guy at this point in his career who goes out and does that 30 times a year. So if you have to face him on one of the 15 or 18 times that he's doing that, then you're in trouble. So again, I don't take it as a reflection of the Blue Jays as a whole. It's not good, but I wouldn't be surprised at all if from here on to the end of the season, the Blue Jays go 13-8 against the American League East.
Yeah, I mean, I don't remember anyone like asking all these questions last year when the Blue Jays went 16-3 against the Boston Red Sox. Like, we just saw it happen. Like, weird stuff happens in baseball. You know, were the Red Sox like a tremendous team last year? No, but they were like right around 500. It wasn't like going 16-3 against this year's Oakland Athletics or something. You went 16-3 against like a decent 500 MLB average team. Like, weird stuff happens. So that's kind of what I chalk that up to. Want to move on to Alek Manoah, because that's obviously the biggest topic in Blue Jays land right now. Ben, when you heard on Tuesday when John Schneider announced Alek Manoah is going to start Friday against the Detroit Tigers, what was your initial reaction?
I was surprised, for sure. I was surprised. Were you surprised as well?
I wasn't surprise. Well, I don't know if surprise is the right word. Like, I was honestly like thinking on Tuesday about what I was going to say on this podcast, knowing that we were going to record on Wednesday. I was going to make a case that Alek Manoah should start that game. Wow. So that's kind of why I wasn't. But I also thought, I was like, oh, well, this will be different, right? I don't think anyone else is going to be saying this. And I actually do believe it. So, you know, I was building my case for that just to say something interesting and novel. So maybe that's part of the reason why I wasn't surprised.
Oh, the Blue Jays stole a hot take away from you by agreeing with you. Who knows how it's going to go, right? Like, and maybe the Blue Jays will look like geniuses. Maybe Manoah goes out there and absolutely shoves against the Tigers, and this is the start of his comeback. And that would be an awesome story, and I'd be here for that. And that would be a lot of fun. I know both you and I will be in Detroit covering that game on Friday. Looking forward to seeing it, however it unfolds. So, you know, as a baseball fan, it's a cool story to see whether he can come back. At the same time, I think any reasonable observer has to have some questions about where Alek Manoah is going to be. Now, the Blue Jays obviously have a lot of information on this. They have the pitch tracking data for Manoah. They have information on his mechanics. They've spoken to him. They got reasons for making this decision. But at the same time, from the outside, knowing what it is that we know, I think it's reasonable to have some questions as to whether one start, one very good start on Sunday at AA New Hampshire, is enough to really be indicative of a turnaround to the point that Manoah is good enough to retire major league hitters. So I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that he's able to go out there and pitch effectively at the major league level, because what we've seen from him all of this year is that it's been a challenge. Now, I don't know what's going to happen, but I think it's reasonable to have some real questions, even against a lineup that probably veers toward the quad A side of things in the Tigers.
So then what would you say would be enough? Like, what would satisfy the I've seen enough from Alek Manoah in the minors to bring him back to the major leagues?
Well, so part of it would be throwing strikes, and
which he's been doing.
Well, once he did it.
I mean, in both outings, he threw strikes. Just in the Coast League, they got, or the Complex League, they got hammered. And at AA, threw strikes as well.
The next swing and a miss. He struck him out. 5 strikeouts in a row for Alek Manoah.
And they were more effective. They got 10, got him 10 Ks.
So you got strikes in both outings. Now, velocity and stuff. I don't have the rate. I know he touched 95 in the start against New Hampshire.
Final pitch of the game in New Hampshire was 95 per John Schneider.
We didn't get the detailed pitch data on his slider, how many swings and misses it got. I would obviously want to see that. And I would want to see a guy who is really pitching with pace, who's not out there, you know, lurking around the mound and waiting 30 seconds between pitches, throwing in balls to get new ones. I wouldn't want to see a ton of mound conferences. I'd want to see him pitching with pace, pitching with conviction. I wasn't there, obviously, at either one of those starts, so unclear how much of that he was able to pull off. And I would want to see it for more than one start, more than one minor league start that's effective. Like, because again, like, what happens if he struggles now? Like, what happens if he struggles against the top? What do you do then? You know, like, so just me personally, I would have wanted to see one more.
So I'm just not as conservative about it, I think, as a lot of people are, or as cautious about it, because I think the reaction for many folks is, well, that's quick. Like, that feels rushed. That's soon. And I guess my response to that would be, well, like, based on what? What is the comparable here? Like, what is the example of the right way to do this? Like, what's the prior context of the Cy Young finalist who suddenly fell off a cliff and had 2 months where he looked lost and had to go to the minor leagues to find himself again? Like, and so who's to say it's quick? Like, you're not basing it on anything. If Hyunjin Ryu was coming up to start on Friday, I would say that's quick. Because we've seen hundreds, if not thousands, of Tommy John rehabilitations that tell us that, like, you need to gradually build up, and there are velocity fluctuations, and there can be, setbacks and soreness and things that guys have to go through. Like, we've seen that play out many, many times before. This is a new case study with Alek Manoah. Like, you're charting a new course. So to say that, like, it's quick, or this, I've seen enough, like, to me, there's just nothing empirical that's based on. It's just a feeling, and I'm kind of trying to make these decisions based on evidence and facts and what actually happened, rather than, oh, that feels rushed.
And that's a really good point when you're talking about, data around Tommy John recovery. This is not an injury. It has been a month in the minor leagues, so that's reasonable. And clearly the Blue Jays agree with you. this is not a decision that they would make lightly. They obviously agree with the Zwelling school of thought on this one. I think that there are reasonable points to be made in that favor. And the Tigers are extremely right-handed heavy. The Blue Jays need Alek Manoah. They don't want to continue relying on bullpen games. There is a cost to that. All of that stuff holds up. And I think best case scenario, Manoah is able to at least perform to some degree against the Tigers. Maybe it's not perfect, but he goes from there and builds up, and then you move ahead. So the upside is absolutely there when you're talking about a guy who finished third in Cy Young Award voting last year. This is the upside play. I also just think that there's such a huge range of outcomes for Alek Manoah this year. And at this point, with him only having made one effective rehab start, there is also a wide range of downside outcomes here. Like, what happens, again, if he goes out there and he just loses the zone? And I know I'm thinking, like, kind of catastrophic here, but, like, we saw it the last time he was on a major league mound. It's not necessarily that much of a reach. And if he is losing the zone now and he goes out there for three more starts, I guess at that point you just option him again and you put Ryu in. But I don't know, man. It's like, I just would have wanted one more.
So if you play out that doomsday scenario where he goes out and he walks first batter on four pitches and he's laboring, he's kicking at the landing spot on the mound, his tempo's all out of whack, Alejandro Kirk's making mound visits, Pete Walker's out twice, throws 40 pitches in the first inning, like, just disaster outing. What was one more minor league start going to do to preempt any of that? Or to convince you that any of that wasn't going to, like, if that's what happens, if that's how this plays out, you have way bigger problems. And one more minor league outing wasn't going to be like, oh, okay, there's my fastball command. Like, there's the extra inch of horizontal on my slider. Like, at some point, you sort of just have to figure out if he has it or he doesn't.
At some point, you have to make that call. At some point you do. And to me, that point would not have been Friday. Now, again, I'm not saying it won't work. And I'm not saying that I wouldn't be super intrigued to follow this story, because I would be. And, I'm not wishing for him to do poorly at all. I think it would be a great story if he does amazing and throws a shutout. But I just think when you're talking about someone who is struggling to the extent that he was, I think that building back with a little bit more deliberation would have made sense. And, I've spoken to people outside of the Jays organization who looked at this and thought, "Ooh, that's pretty quick." But again, Manoah can go out there and prove people wrong, and it certainly wouldn't be the first time he's done that.
The 3-2 on the way, and a swing and a miss to get him. Two down.
Soft stuff early in the count, and then when you need that strikeout, climb the ladder, go up and away with that fastball.
Yeah, again, quick compared to what? Compared to the other time that this
happened? Quick because he had one good start. Quick because he had only one good start.
I'll tell you the other thing I like about this spot as well. Like, it's kind of a confluence of, on the one hand, being like a very soft entry point. To your point, he's going to be facing a bad offense. It has a ton of right-handed pitchers. It's not a very competitive team. He's coming off of like as good of a platform outing as you're going to get. 10 strikeouts over five innings. Like, you can't really fake 10 strikeouts over that amount of time. Like, you're like that. That is for real. And just like reading Shai Davidi's reporting from, I don't know if it was in New Hampshire, wherever that game took place.
It was,
like,
yeah,
from in New Hampshire. Like, sounded like the confidence was there. Like, Shai described it as the swag on the mound that we've seen from him in the past. So like, I can't imagine a better like outing to like come off of for your return to the big leagues as well. You have the All-Star break immediately after this. So if this start goes well, great. Then you go into the All-Star break, throw a couple bullpens, you carry that like confidence through, and you come out of the break. If the start doesn't go well, you are still going to have like a pretty good amount of time after it to figure things out and to decide your next move and to say like, hey, you know, what are we going to do here? Like, either way, he's going to start Friday. Then you got two more games. Then you got the All-Star break. Then you got three against Arizona coming out of it and an off day. Either way, whether this goes well or not, you can give Alek Manoah like 10 days between big league outings in between. So you've got a very nice bubble there where you can either like try to like get him back into the lab or get him back on a mound, get him back into bullpens and try to build off of things or try to correct whatever went wrong. So I think that's a big benefit. I also think like the stakes of this game are very low. Like, Ben, just to be honest with you, there's a reason why you and I are covering the weekend series in Detroit leading into the All-Star break for Sportsnet. I think the stakes of this game are very low. I think the attention on it is very low. And I think that if it is a disaster, like, you go right into the All-Star break and like the coverage of the team comes down and the attention on the team comes down. So like, if it really is a disaster, that kind of goes away rather quickly.
Oh man.
I think so.
I gotta disagree with you there. I think they're two games back in the wild card. I think every game right now has significance, and especially against the Tigers, you only get so many chances to play these really underperforming teams. So I think this game has massive stakes. I think that every game at this point for the Blue Jays, given where they are in their cycle, given where they are with Bo and with Vlad, you cannot fail to make the most of this season, and so they need to make the playoffs. I think this game is big.
I think that you have a decent chance of winning that game regardless of if Alek Manoah goes seven shutty or if he gives up like four over four innings, you know,
or if you had Trevor Richards and Bowden Francis.
That's the other thing, is like, you feel a lot better with your bullpen this weekend if Trevor Richards is like pitching the seventh and available to pitch the seventh, even against the White Sox here, because like if Trevor Richards is starting Friday, well, he's probably not pitching Wednesday or Thursday against the White Sox. Yep. He probably don't have Bowden Francis to, you know, mop up some innings if need be, pitching low leverage if need be out of the bullpen. It also like allows you to buy rest for Kevin Gausman, Jose Berríos, Chris Bassett, guys who have been pitching on a four-man rotation, which is extremely suboptimal, and guys who have been skipping bullpens and pitching through physical ailments and like unable to work on things in between outings and maintain their stuff and really like get into the rhythms, the routines that they need in order to be their best and to be effective and to carry the exceptionally high workloads that you indicated earlier. The other flip side of this, from like the, you know, that is kind of interesting to me, that kind of is coupled with the low stakes angle of this and the soft entry point and all that, is it shows a lot of confidence in Alek Manoah. And it tells him, hey, we have a lot of confidence in the work that you did over the last month. We believe that you are back. Like, we believe that like what you showed us in New Hampshire was good and that you're in a good place and that you are ready to come back and contribute to this team and be a part of this. You are an important part of this. You are our opening day starter. We have all the confidence in the world that while everyone else is saying that this is quick and this is rushed, we are saying, no, you are ready now. It shows some good confidence in him. I think it gives him a good boost. And I think it also shows like some goodwill to Alek Manoah, who you just removed from the major league roster for a month, who you just cost millions of dollars by, you know, preventing his ability to become a Super 2 player and take four trips through arbitration rather than three. You get him back quicker to earning big league service, earning big league pay, enjoying big league perks on the flights, you know, the charters, the spreads, all that stuff, I think it builds some goodwill with him and shows some confidence in him as well.
All true. All true. I don't want to sound like I'm an Alek Manoah naysayer here. You know, like maybe he's able to come out and maybe this is the start of a huge second half. And I, as I said, I'm totally open to that. To me, it just would have been one more start and then he comes back and he pitches against the Diamondbacks at home in the first series out of the break and, you know, you roll from there. So I think, you know, as much as it probably sounds like you and I are totally opposite ends of the spectrum here, I'm like one game away from bringing Manoah back. You know, I'm one more good start at Double A, strikeout 7 over 5 innings, boom, he's back in there the next time through. And this is, to me, it's a little rushed. I mean, we'll see. The Tigers are a good entry point, so we'll see how it plays out.
For all the chatter and attention and spotlight on this the super important series that you and I are driving down to Detroit to cover this weekend, it's probably going to be like 5 innings and 3 runs, right?
Yeah, and they would be thrilled with that. They'd be thrilled with that. And maybe if the offense can go out there and kind of find its form a little bit, you buy him a little bit of run support and it becomes that much simpler to be able to get a win in his first game back.
All right, that's Alek Manoah. We got to talk about the All-Star break and we got to talk about the trade deadline and so much more when it continues on At the Letters.
Listen to At the Letters ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
So Ben, as mentioned in the first segment of the podcast, we are approaching the All-Star break. Programming note for ATL listeners, we're going to take a break over the All-Star break and kind of recharge, so no episode next week. But when we are not recording next week, Ben, and there's an All-Star game on, there's a home run derby, there's whatever the hell else happens during that span, will you be watching? Will you be consuming? Are you an All-Star guy? Where do you stand?
Well, normally I do watch the All-Star game and the home run derby, and so good chance that I will next week as well. Like I really like the home run derby. I think the home run derby can be so much fun.
When Vlad Sr. won in 2007, he won 3-2 in the final round.
Right.
We just saw 21 and 16 in the first round. That's just impressive.
I think they should shorten it. I think it runs a little too long. Like, I don't want to sit there for 3 hours, but I would watch it for like 2 hours 10 if there was a way for them just to tighten it. But it's so fun, and you can really feed off of the energy that the players have, like Vlad Jr., of course, when he's there, Julio Rodriguez. You know, obviously, you think back to Josh Hamilton in the home run derby or some of the great performances that we've seen. And it's so much fun. So I really like the derby. I think the All-Star game obviously is the best All-Star game in pro sports. I think there's some things that they could do to improve it, but I think it's a great spectacle. And yeah, I enjoy the whole thing. I mean, I think there's some things they could do with that entire week, including, you know, and we can get into this, but I would put the futures game on the Wednesday, maybe like a night where you don't have a lot of baseball instead of having the futures game on a Sunday where you have major league games. Same with the draft. I mean, I think it makes sense to have the draft in and around this time, but I would make the draft more of a showcase. I would put the draft on one of those down days, like the Thursday. And then you go home run derby, All-Star game, futures game, draft, something like that. And those events are able to stand out a little bit more instead of being buried by the onslaught of major league games that ultimately are going to take people's focus.
I don't know what this says about me. I'm like more interested in the futures game. Is that weird? Because those kids are trying. Like they're really trying to impress. I think about the like Arizona Fall League All-Star game that I watched one year. And I remember like Pete Alonso took Nate Pearson deep. And I think Nate threw like 104 or something crazy like that. And Alonso like just crushed it. Like it was cool watching some like of future stars of the game compete on that stage because it really is like a showcase for them and it really matters to them. To me, there's more juice in that than in an actual All-Star game between actual major leaguers.
Yeah, I mean, the futures game is fun for sure. I think the All-Star game, like I think players try in the All-Star game. I think they try to put on a show if only for the other players. I don't think they're too worried about the fans, but I think they really want to show to the other players, you know, that they are as good as everyone says they are. And I think that can be a lot of fun. So I do like the All-Star game a lot. I don't necessarily believe that every team should have an all-star. I'm not sure that we're at that point. I would tighten the rosters in general. And I would also create some rule changes. Like, I think that, you know, let's say, I know Mike Trout's injured. So we'll say Shohei Ohtani, okay? Let's say Ohtani starts the game at DH. Then you remove him, right? Because you want to get someone else in. So you bring in, I don't know, Wander Franco to DH for a couple innings. I would definitely allow it so that you could bring Shohei Ohtani back into the game in some capacity. I think that would be pretty fun. You know, it's an all-star game. It doesn't matter. I think that would be pretty cool. Even if he's just a pinch runner, you know, late in the game for somebody who gets on base, I think that could be a way to make things a little bit more entertaining. But I think the game of baseball is obviously a compelling one. And when you put all those players together on the same field, I think it leads to a pretty good product.
Yeah, the game doesn't matter and there's nothing at stake. So why not blow up the rule set? Like, who cares? It doesn't matter if Shohei Ohtani goes in and out of the game five times. Like, it's who cares? What tradition are you really upholding? What kind of, you know, sacred all-star history are you disrespecting by doing that? But that's part of the reason why, like, I really don't watch the all-star game. I don't watch the home run derby. Like, I don't watch any of it because, like, I watch so much baseball. If there's no stakes in it, it's hard for me to be interested.
Yeah. You know, I think that's probably why the games that I gravitate to, and I presume you probably gravitate to, are, you know, the Dodgers versus the Padres, as opposed to watching the Rockies play the Royals. You know, it is more compelling when you have something at stake. And I think it would be really cool if they found a way to create some stakes for the All-Star game. Obviously, they tried that by tying home field advantage in the World Series to it. That was way too far. But, you know, as you said, this isn't like it. The All-Star game is cool. And as I said, I think it's the best of all the pro sports for sure. And there's a limit to how good an All-Star game is ever going to be. I mean, you're never going to reach the same tension that you get in a wild card game or in a game seven, you know? So I think that we have to understand there's a limit there, but you can play with it. I mean, they used to have two All-Star games every year, right? Like, this is not such a holy event that can never be tinkered with. And we've seen some willingness to do that, even with the way they televise the game, getting a lot of players involved in the broadcast, like Alec Manoa last year, which can be really cool. And I think that because the vast, vast majority of fans who are consuming it via TV, the TV broadcast, which I think Fox has the American rights, that has huge implications as to how it's going to be perceived. And I think you can do some creative things with different camera shots and with different players involved, interview the managers in game. I mean, I personally always hate listening to in-game interviews of players. I don't know what your thoughts are on this, you know, given your role on the sidelines this year, but it just feels like a bit too much when the stakes are high. You want them to be focused on actually executing a game plan. But in the All-Star game, that goes out the window. So you can interview players and interview coaches. And I think that is a way to open fans up to the game in ways that you wouldn't normally see it.
If the player's uninvolved, I'm for it. So if it's like yesterday's starter, like hearing
that's fun. You
talk to him for an inning.
Yes.
That's interesting. Yeah, when it's the guy who just hit a home run and is now talking to the sideline reporter in the dugout, I don't think that anybody's getting any value from that.
Yeah, exactly. And when you see the, like, even because I think for the Apple TV games, the broadcasters do interview the managers in between innings. And I know it's between innings and it's taped and they air it right after. But even then, I know it's obviously the rights holder wants that. That's obviously included in their deal. But I just think it just reads as a little bit like you're just getting a little bit too in there. I think that the manager and the coach in that situation deserve the chance to game plan, reset, think their, you know, next moves through, as opposed to having to do in-game media.
As a consumer, I get nothing from that access.
Yeah.
Honestly. It's like in the NFL or in college football, it's the coach running off to the locker room talking to a reporter, you know?
Right. And it's always two-word answers.
Yeah, you get nothing. Or in the NBA, it's like Greg Popovich doing two questions in between the third and fourth quarter and like making a mockery of it because he's telling you, yes, this is absurd. Why would I tell you, why would I reveal anything to you right now during a game? What do I have to gain from that?
It's during the game, you know, like they're in the midst of trying to accomplish something, you know, whereas in the All-Star game, you can totally do that. And I think that it's actually, you know, really fun. I think that you can do a lot there. You can have players on mics. You could have players mic'd up together. You could have a whole outfield mic'd up and talking to the broadcast crew if you wanted to. I mean, there's really no limit to the ways that you could connect fans to the game in that way. And it takes nothing away from the integrity of the competition.
You should give the hitter a pitch go home and let him call the pitches.
Yeah.
The pitcher is going to throw.
That'd be awesome.
Try to hit them. All right. So you said that home field being decided by the All-Star game was like a bridge too far for you, right? That was too much?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm going to blow that out of the water with my proposal right now.
Let's
see. So you're going to be against this in a very big way.
Okay.
Here's what I think we should do at the All-Star break. The top team in each league. So in the American League, that's the Tampa Bay Rays. In the National League, that's the Atlanta Braves, right? The top team in each league is going to play a three-game series against an all-star team made up of players from the rest of the league. So it's going to be the Rays versus the American League All-Stars. And it's going to be the Braves versus the National League All-Stars. In a three-game series, if the Rays win two of those games, the Rays or the Braves win two of the three, if they win the series, they get a bye to the championship series.
Oh, wow.
And the all-star team is playing to deny them of that. And if the all-star team wins the series, then the postseason just continues on as it was going to be.
Okay, so I sort of love that. I also, there are some tweaks that I would need, though. I think the concept is actually awesome. So I think a three-game series is, you know, these teams, these players, they need a break. Like, you can't have the Rays having to play through their entire All-Star break with no break whatsoever. So
the reward is so great. It makes it, like, it incentivizes them to do that.
I agree, but I also think even from like a, you know, when you think about Major League Baseball and their jewel events, I don't think that they're going to try to go to Fox and say, hey, we have a three-game series for you. I think that the TV rights holders probably like the one-game aspect.
You don't think they like the stakes and how many people would watch this because of how much is on the line? They wouldn't like the viewership?
I think they would love the viewership. And this is where I actually kind of like the concept. So I think it has to be one game, though. So I would go one game and then, man, all the way to the American League Championships here. I guess because the top team is already sort of positioned to... Mm-hmm. Okay, here's what I would do. I would do, instead of giving them all the way to the championship series, I would have it be one game and I would have it be they start the division series up 1-0. If they make it, if they continue to hold on to their position, they start the division series up 1-0.
I'm okay with that. That's a little bit of a reduction in the stakes, but it still is stakes. So I like it because that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to introduce stakes.
Oh, and the stakes would be massive. And honestly, like do you have two games then? You have one American League game and one National League game?
Yeah.
Right. Because otherwise, if you're trying to sell six games and you're trying to fit six games in, I think that's probably too unwieldy for the week. I guess you could do afternoon games, but you know, I think the two games actually work. So you go maybe Tuesday and Wednesday of All-Star week. Story to the Futures game. They're getting back bumped off the primetime schedule. That's fine.
But kids,
you go Tuesday and Wednesday of the All-Star week. And you go American League, and honestly, that would be amazing TV. Like, that
wouldn't it be great?
So I actually kind of like it. I actually kind of like this idea.
You still get the all-star element because you still get your all-star team for each league. Yep. And if you want, you could still do like have fans vote in the starters, or you could do like a selection committee of the, like, say the, you know, the other four teams are in playoff position. Their GMs and managers get to like select the rosters or whatever.
Right. Yeah.
Or you could still do it by fan vote, or it could be the fans vote the starters and the selection committee like constructs the rest of the roster. You'd have to, you know, pick who's going to like manage that team and who's going to like deploy them. But it would introduce some actual stakes while preserving the all-starness of it, for lack of a better word, and give people a reason to watch.
Yeah. I mean, I think I think the stakes are undeniable. Like, it would be so compelling. It would be really, really fun. I think you could still have fans voted in. Fans and players, and the current system is extremely convoluted, but it actually works at getting the All-Stars who deserve to be there for the most part. You rarely run into a question of, like, this All-Star team isn't good. I mean, you end up with really, really talented groups. I think, too, like, the manager question is interesting because, you know, usually you're going to have the All-Star game managed by the manager of the team that made it to the World Series the previous year. And so if that team also happened to be the team with the top record, which wouldn't be the case this year, but that could be the case very easily, then you would, I guess, have to defer to the manager of the second place team or something on those lines.
Yeah, totally. Like, what the Rays and Braves are playing for is enormous. Like, that's a huge advantage to have. But, like, A, they have earned that by being so as successful as they have over the first 85 games or 90 games, however many games they played before the All-Star break. And B, like, the odds are stacked against them because they are playing a team of the best players from the rest of the league. Like, they're playing a literal All-Star team. So if they can beat an All-Star team,
they deserve
that it. Is a feat, and they deserve the reward that they would be getting.
Okay, so furthering my interest in this scenario is the fact that it wouldn't happen this year, but in a lot of years, this would actually create incredible stakes going into the final weekend of the season. Because if you had, let's say it was the Astros and the Rangers who were battling for the top spot in the American League, and they're playing maybe separate series, or maybe they're even playing against each other, well, you really want to be the team that finishes first, because then you get the chance to secure yourself that one game advantage. So then you really have to sell out in the final few games leading up to the All-Star break for the opportunity. And that would change the way teams manage and teams play in those final few games. So I think it would, beyond the All-Star game itself, it would actually lend intrigue to the last few games of the first half.
Just keeps getting better. I really didn't think that you would be sold on this.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's definitely an upgrade on the current system. I think this would be awesome. I think if you just kept it to one game, give them a one game advantage, or let's say one game and home field, something like that, then you're looking at really compelling baseball.
All right, Ben, pulling the conversation back into the reality of MLB and not my made up fantastical ideas that will never happen. We got a trade deadline coming up in 4 weeks. Do you think that we're getting a clearer sense at this point of what shape the market will take, who the buyers are, what the pool of sellers looks like, or is there still a lot to be decided?
I think it's still pretty murky out there, really. And, you know, the White Sox are probably a perfect example of that, where they're obviously trending in the direction of being sellers, but the AL Central is so weak that they're actually not that far out. They're 7 games out as we record this. So, you know, a good 2 weeks, maybe they're 3.5 out. Maybe that changes things. And, you know, obviously that's a team that would probably prefer not to sell. No one wants to sell if there's any way around it. Same applies to the Cubs, or same applies to the Mariners. Some of these teams, the Padres, obviously, the Mets, they are just kind of waiting for the possibility of a win streak. And if they can pull one off, that would change everything. So I think that it's hard to get a real crystal clear idea of who's buying, who's selling. Clearly, some teams are going to be buyers. The Blue Jays are in that mix. But there's a lot of uncertainty still, and I think it's going to be a late developing deadline.
Yeah, even outside of just the East divisions in either league, the other four divisions are all still pretty hotly contested. And so that, like, even just lengthens the field, because I don't think that, you know, Cleveland or Minnesota is going to be like one of the three wildcard teams, but I know one of them's going to win that division, and they're both like still very much in the running for that division. Like the Milwaukee Brewers, like maybe not a wildcard team, but absolutely in the running to take down the Reds in the Central. So in the NL. So like it is super muddled and murky right now. But I do think that that creates the opportunity for quite a bit of creativity among front offices and maybe some more unorthodox trades that we don't always see at the deadline, where it's purely like win now player in exchange for future prospects. I wonder if there's a lot more room for like challenge trades and for MLB or for MLB or trades, whether that's with like teams with high payrolls, but sort of like disappointing-ish results to this point, whether that's with low payroll clubs that are kind of like perpetually looking to refresh their roster with controllable win now talent who are in position to contend for the postseason. So like thinking of like those Brewers or those Cleveland Guardians, like I do think that there is probably more room this year for those kinds of trades if front offices can get together and get creative.
For sure. And, you know, the Blue Jays are front and center in that because they are approaching a point where their 40-man is going to start churning over. And you look at even the return of Ryu and Chad Green means that they are going to have to create two 40-man spots. Then you get to the fact that we're expecting them to add in some form. So is that one or two more major league players? Let's call it two. So then you're looking at four roster spots. And then what if you want to add a Davis Schneider, for example, to the 40-man and bolster your major league team? All of a sudden, you're talking about a significant chunk of your 40-man roster that is going to have to turn over. Now, of course, you can DFA guys. I mean, teams do it all the time. It's not the end of the world. But you also have the chance to potentially create some trades off of your 40-man roster and cycle some guys out to other teams that might have a better fit for them, that might have view them in different ways. And so I actually think that if you're the Blue Jays, you should be looking to trade off your 40-man roster at this point.
Yeah, and even to add to why the Blue Jays make sense in that framework is a relatively thin farm system and one that doesn't have like a lot of obvious candidates to be traded for like controllable win now talent. Like, are you really wanting to eat further into your starting pitching depth and trade a Ricky Tiedemann or Brandon Barriera? Are you going to be looking to move an Aurelvis Martinez, who has like made huge strides in terms of his discipline and his plate approach and gotten the strikeouts under control and started walking more often and shown like really big power? Are you going to want to move an Addison Barger when you might need a third baseman next year? Like, I think for a lot of reasons, the Blue Jays could make sense as that club that could make that MLB or for MLB or move. We just saw them make one with Arizona in the offseason. I mean, Varsho for Gurriel and Moreno, like those are three current MLBers. Like that was an MLBer for MLBer trades. So we know that like the possibility is there and the creativity is there and that the Blue Jays can do it. And it's probably even an easier sell to a clubhouse with a team that's results look the way that they do. Like if the Blue Jays were running away with the division lead, it would be really hard to kind of sell to your clubhouse, hey, we're trading somebody who has contributed to this and helped us be a winner. Like we're going to disrupt things, you know, on our roster and in our clubhouse right now. But just looking at the way that this season has played out, I think you actually can make a case to the group that we have to change something. We have to get better. We have to find a way to have improved results going forward, or else we're all going to be watching the postseason from our couches.
That's right. And, you know, you look at this roster, I think the big pieces are here to stay. I think they're here in place probably for multiple years for the most part. And really, it's on those players to perform better than they have, whether that's Kirk, for example, whether that's Manoah, obviously. Vlad Jr. starting to turn things around with four homers in his last 10 games.
Sends this one to right field, and it is gone! An opposite field two-run homer for Vladimir Guerrero Jr.
You know, you want to see that internal improvement. I think the core is what it is, but around that core, you have guys that you could trade. And, you know, this is speculation, and I'm not trying to, you know, create a frenzy of uncertainty around any of these players when I name them, but, you know, could you trade an Adam Simber or a Mitch White or a Hagen Danner or an Otto Lopez? Like, to me, those are players on the 40-man roster that 6 months from now, you know, they very well might not be. And there's always churn. 40-man rosters change all the time. And then every fall, you have to add new players. And there's, you know, that's the cycle of the sport. But this is a time right now, if you're the Jays, where I think they should be really open to that.
Yeah, I mean, how did Mitch White end up a Blue Jay? I think for the Dodgers, they said he's out of options and he's getting to the edge of our 40-man roster because we're really talented and deep. So they found an avenue to move him.
Right, exactly. And they took a shot there. You know, we'll see. Nick Frasso looked really good for a while. He struggled a bit more of late. That was the prospect that went back to LA in that deal. So, you know, we'll see how it all unfolds here. But I do think that that's one kind of version of trades they could explore. And then beyond that, as I've talked about many times, I do think there's room for that right-handed bat. I do think there's room for another reliever. You know, maybe the rotation is actually, depending on how Manoah can do in the next couple of starts and depending on how Ryu's progression continues, the rotation might actually become less of a priority for the Jays. And that would allow them to go out there and maybe you focus more on adding one more reliever and one more bat, and you hope that that's enough to kind of join the main core of this team and push things forward over the last couple months.
To me, those are the needs. It's right-handed power bat that can ideally play the outfield. It is a swing and miss relief arm, like somebody who you feel comfortable pitching in leverage and who can miss bats and get you a strikeout. And it is a length pitcher. Not necessarily a true starter, not necessarily like a swing man. It just someone who can like chew competent innings, like somebody who can pitch bulk efforts, whether that is starting a game or whether that is out of the bullpen. Do you agree those are the three primary targets for this club over the next 4 weeks?
Yeah, I think as things stand right now and with the uncertainty around Manoah, I mean, there's still a need for, you know, like you said, a bulk starting pitcher, someone that allows you to option Bowden Francis to the minors. You're not as reliant on him. You're not as reliant on Trevor Richards. If there's another injury, you have some sort of bulk available to you. And that's maybe even if Manoah comes back and does really well. It's just, it's always nice to have. When they acquired Ross Stripling a couple years ago, obviously Taiwan Walker was a pickup along those lines, just to get some innings. And so I think that that would be up there. And of course, I think we can all see the need for a bat, and every team, every good team needs more relief pitching. And even, you know, watching Joe Kelly, you know, that's the kind of arm where it's, you know, 100 miles an hour, nice little cutter right there, or slider around 90, 91. If he's healthy, if he's pitching well, I mean, that's the kind of arm that would be available. Then you'd have to think the Jays would take a look.
Yeah, someone like a Julian Merriweather would just be perfect.
Yeah, he is doing well. 31% strikeout rate, I think.
Oh, yeah. This is why you never give up. Like, this is why you never write anybody off. Somebody like a Julian Merriweather would be great, as would like a Marcus Stroman for the rotation, or a Teoscar Hernandez as the right-handed power bat. You know, if those guys could somehow in some way be Blue Jays, that would be pretty huge. I do have some like actual real ideas and real targets that I'll throw out there. I'll start with one, and this is the sort of length pitcher. This is the length option, and that's Michael Lorenzen. You're going to see him at the All-Star game, miraculously. I don't know if you agree or not that he's is or is not an All-Star, but that's neither here nor there. But like, that is somebody who you can bring in either to like start as a fifth starter in your rotation if you need him to be. He's been starting lately, last couple of years. He's somebody who has experience as a swing option, going 2 to 3 innings out of the bullpen. You could insert him there and let like Trevor Richards move into a more sort of focused, shorter relief role. This is somebody whose fastball has been up to 97 in shorter stints, averaged 97 as a reliever in 2020 and 2021. He hit 98 this year. Lorenzen did when he was emptying the tank in like a 2-2 count at the end of his outing in a tie game, like clearly reaching back for more. But like, that upper 90s is in there, and I think that in shorter stints you could see more of it. He's got huge spin on his fastball, multiple secondary pitches. I think his slider's better than it's shown. You're not afraid to use him against lefties. He hardly walks anyone. And very, very distant added benefit. This is a very like Varsho-esque scenario with Varsho catching, but Michael Lorenzen can play a passable outfield if you're in a bind. He has 96 defensive innings in the majors 81 of them in center field. Hasn't played there since 2019, but he is playable in the outfield in a pinch, like extra innings scenario, disaster scenario. So that is just a little, another wrinkle to how, you know, he could impact like his utility on a roster.
Seven homers in the majors and a 710 OPS. Get him in the lineup. He'd be an upgrade over half the Jays, am I right? No, I'm just joking, obviously. But I think, he would be helpful. And I have to think, you know, he's making $8.5 million this year. To me, that's not a guy with a ton of trade value. You know, if you're a team like the Blue Jays that's spending to the CBT, you're able to take on a little bit more money than some teams in this game. And so maybe this is one where you send the Tigers, you know, some semi-interesting prospects and you get back a big leaguer in return. You take on the salary that adds a few million to your payroll, but you roll with it. And Lorenzen gives you a little bit of depth. I mean, it's not the most exciting addition, I'm not going to lie to you, but I think it could be. I don't oppose that kind of addition at all. I mean, there's value there for sure, and it allows you to add some depth to the organization.
Yeah, none of these additions are going to be like exciting. Like the obvious names at the top of the market are the obvious names and everybody knows them. And, you know, I just don't think the Blue Jays are going to have that 99th percentile deadline, like that incredible, like they come away with all the splashiest additions. Like when I'm kind of looking at targets, I'm always sort of looking under the radar at guys like this.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. On the hitting side, last week I threw out Tommy Pham as one. I threw out Mark Canha. You know, Ramon Laureano obviously is a guy who could be intriguing. Jerks and Profar, any of those names jump out to you? And Adam Duvall, if the Red Sox decide to sell, any of those names jump out to you?
I like all of the above. I would add one more, and it is like earlier I facetiously threw out some ex-Blue Jays, but this is an ex-Blue Jay who I actually think they should go and acquire. Randall Grichuk. You're already paying part of his salary this year, right? You're already paying the man to play baseball. He is a right-handed power bat who was miscast as an everyday player with the Blue Jays. If you brought him in to be deployed more strategically as like a like only against lefties kind of guy, 878 OPS versus lefties this year. His walk rate's up. His strikeout rate is down. He's not going to kill you defensively in right field. He's not going to be Kiermaier. He's not going to be Varsho. But he's not going to kill you in right. And he can actually cover center in a pinch. He's got so-so speed. We know he's a high-effort player. We know he's durable. We know he's a competitor. And he should be motivated in his walk year at the end of that extension that he originally signed with the Blue Jays like 5 years ago. I think that in a more strategically like deployed just position on the roster as like a fourth outfielder bench type, Randall Grichuk would make sense for this roster.
Well, you know, I think I enthusiastically agreed with you on the all-star idea that you had. This time I'm going to have to like unenthusiastically agree with you. Like nothing that you said there is wrong. Like in fact, it makes a lot of sense. I can't disagree with anything you're saying. I think having seen Randall Grichuk and seen him as an everyday player, whereas you said he was probably miscast as, you know, when I remember when they even introduced their new uniforms, right? It was like Vlad and Bo and Randall Grichuk. And it's like, is this guy really like a core piece of this team? No, but could he be a role player? Like, yeah, I guess, you know what? Like he could be a role player. He could be a guy who gives them a little bit more depth and, you know, Nathan Lucas, you know, a left-handed hitter in the minor leagues. Randall Grichuk is an upgrade over that. He's an upgrade over Ernie Clement. So, yeah, you know, I could get behind that.
Right? He's a fit with your clubhouse. He already knows, like, his new old teammates. He knows the coaching staff. He knows the training staff. It wouldn't be that hard of, like, an assimilation or a jump for him to make his way over to the Blue Jays. Like part of the reason why the Blue Jays traded Randall Grichuk when they did, I think it was ahead of 2022, right? Was because like he wasn't, you know, going to have the playing time that, you know, he wasn't going to have the role that, you know, he felt that he should have. So he went to Colorado and found that role there. But now as kind of like the grizzled vet going back to Toronto, like I said, you're already paying him anyway. I think he makes some sense on this team.
Wow. I mean, it would be something else. And, you know, there are a lot of former Jays out there that are going to be front and center, right? I think Marcus Stroman has a chance to be the guy who's obviously not going to the Jays, but you know, someone who's really coveted at the deadline. Who knows what the Mariners decide to do with Teoscar Hernandez, but should be a lot of intrigue out there for some former Jays.
As we wrap up, any relievers you want to point, like there's always a million of them at every deadline. I have one in particular in mind that I want to highlight, but I'll let you shout somebody out if there's anyone you want to point people to.
Yeah, no one really jumps out to me as far as, hey, you absolutely have to target this guy. I think that so much of it too is you want someone who's pitching really well in that moment. And so really it's in the next 3 weeks. You want to see how guys are doing, what kind of, you know, strike throwing, what kind of velo, what kind of swing and miss they're getting, how they're bouncing back from outings back to back, for example. So you have to be really on it with your whole system that you have for understanding what's happening around the major leagues. And as you start to dial in a little closer on guys, have some pro scouts on players. But July 5th, it's almost like, you know, if you're a buying team, you're thinking about giving up a halfway decent prospect. You really want to be sure he's doing well in that moment, not he did well in April and his season numbers still look okay.
Well, Ben, the good news is that Arden's pro scouting department has found another winner in the dredges and the on the edges of a non-contenders roster. You might see him this week coming out of the White Sox bullpen. His name's Kenyon Middleton, and he has just come out of nowhere this year to like really turn his career around at the age of 28, 29. He's got a super red Savant page. We're talking 92nd percentile or better in K rate, whiff rate, chase rate, 82nd percentile in average exit velo, like well above average velo. He's got spin, he's got extension. He has an extremely spotty track record. He has bounced around. He was a minor league signing over the winter, didn't even crack the White Sox opening day roster, but was called up in April, and he appears to be putting it together in a very big way. It's like a 32% strikeout rate, nearly a 60% ground ball rate, very strong expected statistics. You look at what he's doing differently this year. He has started throwing his changeup as his primary weapon, which is something that he had never done before in his career. You know the Blue Jays will love that. They love an unorthodox guy with a different pitch mix. He's also got a slider that he locates really well against righties. He's got like a 96-mile-per-hour fastball that he doesn't necessarily always command, but that's okay because he's primarily a changeup slider guy now. When you watch him pitch, it's like a really unorthodox arm path with this weird release point and kind of deceptive approach angles and an odd delivery. We know the Blue Jays like that. They like guys who get their fastball off of that meatball plane. I think that Kenyon Middleton would be a good target.
Yeah, I like it. I like it. He's definitely got a bit more high impact potential than a Randall Grichuk or a Lorenzen. I think this is a good pick for sure. Looking at his baseball reference page, wow, did he ever time his walk here perfectly, because he really went from being a borderline big leaguer, you know, edge of the roster type player to if he continues this, he's going to go out there and sign for like, you know, $21 million over 2 years or something this offseason, the way he's pitching. So yeah, I think he's going to be in demand. You know, if the White Sox do sell, he'll be in a lot of demand, and the Jays should be one of those teams pursuing him.
All right, Ben, we have rebuilt the Blue Jays. We've fixed the All-Star break. We've decided exactly what's going to happen with Alek Manoah. I think we did good work this week.
That's right. I mean, it's too bad we're taking next week off. Who knows what we could have accomplished with another episode.
Yes, we will be away next week recuperating and recharging, but then we'll be back after that when the Blue Jays are on the other side of the All-Star break. So I want to thank all of you for listening. I want to thank Christian Ryan for producing. He's Ben Nicholson-Smith. My name's Arden Zwelling. We'll talk to you next time on At the Letters.